You're listening to Face Off, episode 81, recorded August 8th, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jay Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
We're coming to you today from beautiful Bozeman, Montana. And in this podcast, we'll talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes for the show by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, yeah, gorgeous day out. End of summer is sort of coming, though. Not really. It's kind of like...
Not yet, but...
Yeah.
It's getting there.
And it's been a short one. We've had a lot of cold weather at the beginning of it, so...
It's definitely hot now.
Yeah, that is absolutely for sure. Let's get into our news and follow-ups. We actually have a piece of news. This is pretty interesting because we talked about this on Face Off, and I don't want to do the old, you know, I told you so bit, but the one thing we found out is Google Wave is closing. Not kind of closing. Google has said that...
It's not going to be a standalone product. They might use the technology and things. But
Wave itself, they're not going to do any sort of support on it, I believe, for the next year. And then after a while, they're gonna sunset and close it. So
yeah, they're not gonna develop. From what I understand, they're not developing. They're gonna maintain the website that's already there, and they're probably gonna use the technology and other Google services, according to the blog article. But it is not going to be a product anymore. Google Wave is not gonna be Google Wave.
Yeah. So we actually talked about this on Face Off when it was launched, and I mean, I guess my thought was like, what I thought the best Google innovations were. Were when they took sort of something that existed and was clunky and they made it better. Like, I think great examples of this are, Gmail. Yeah, everybody hated email. It was a big pain. Google made it. They put it in the cloud. They made it awesome, really rich web interface. So all of a sudden, email was really useful and awesome. There was IM, which there had been like a bunch of different protocols. There was this open source protocol called Jabber that no one's really using. Google sort of adopted it, made it really easy to use so that you could use it in the web. You can IM in your Gmail interface, which you had open all the time anyways. Again, existing technology making it really easy. Google Voice, phone and voicemail sucks. So they took Google Voice. You know, they made the phone easier to use. Wave was not like that. Wave was a sort of its own thing. They were trying to make a new protocol. It wasn't really IM. It wasn't really email. It wasn't really document editing. It was kind of a mishmash of both. And I thought that was something that was not what Google was really good at in general. That wasn't sort of me. Like, their core competency, again, was taking things that sucked and making better. And this was like a whole new thing. Like, we're going to revolutionize the way the world communicates by open sourcing Wave and its protocol. And it just didn't happen. And I think that's why.
Yeah, it's, it had a great technology, and when it first came out, I was like, whoa, that's cool, but nobody knew what to do with it. Like,
yeah.
You know? Like, we used it for a couple days, and I was like,
yeah, we tried it, and, at work, we started using it a little bit here towards the end, which is kind of funny now that they're closing it. We would do, like, our work meeting notes on it, which was kind of okay, but still was clunky because it was kind of threaded, so we made a Wave called, like, work meeting notes, but then it's like you had to keep adding to it rather than, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, well, really, it should be a different Wave for meeting notes so that we could converse about stuff inside the meeting, but... I don't know. I just thought it was something that, you know, I never kept it open. So every once a month, I would log in and see that there's maybe an update to a couple Waves. And then, you know, but, and I think that's why I think the reason it fell is just because it was a new thing that wasn't existing that sucked it. They solved a question that didn't exist, I think,
mm-hmm.
or a problem. They solved a problem that didn't exist. You know, like I said, email sucked. Make it better. This is like, well, what sucks? I have IM, I have email, I have Google Docs, which is, you know, collaborative document editing. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
I don't think it's a total loss, though. I think they're going to take the technology and put it in other Google services that are already, you know, like maybe in Gmail or, well, they did that kind of with Buzz and a few things, but
yeah,
I don't know. I don't think it's a total loss, but yeah, like you said, they're good at making things, you know, that are already there. They make them better. They're engineers. They study things. They do stats on them and mm-hmm. see what features people are using, make those easier to use. And, you know, but like coming up with something new, I can't think of anything that they've, you know, any product like that they've made that was really revolutionary. That was a new idea, kind of like Wave.
Right. Yeah. And oftentimes when they did it, it kind of flopped like this. The one thing I did think is a lot of people, myself including, were kind of doing the like, you know, I said Wave sucked, I didn't like it, you know, but one thing that did get brought up is, I can't remember who it was, some lady on Twitter, you know, said, to all you Google Wave haters, you know, put your heart and soul out there and see what, you know, and have people, you know, take a, you know, people slap it back at you and make fun of it and stuff and see how you feel. And so I'm sad that sucks for the people that made Wave. That does suck because they did a lot of work into it. They're very proud of it. You know, they're very excited and it did fail. So I'm sorry to them for that. That does suck. But also it's really smart of Google to say, we have probably, I would think, a lot of infrastructure built into this because it wasn't, I mean, it was not a lightweight thing what they were doing. It was doing a lot of hardcore stuff and they weren't getting the adoption they wanted to. So they're going to sunset it and that's cool. But again, sorry to the Wave developers. That sucks.
Yep.
All right, let's get into our geek tool of the week. I am a firm believer, Mark, that whiteboards are very important in our profession.
I like whiteboards. I use them all the time.
Yeah, me too. So I was really excited when I found this. They're called peel and stick whiteboards. Now, there's been like sort of small paper-sized whiteboards forever that you could get, like, you know, you put on your locker and usually they have like this cardboard backing and then like you put these the little foam adhesive squares on the back and then you try to take them off your wall and they rip your wallpaper off and all kinds of terrible stuff. These peel and stick ones, you can get them on Amazon. You get the link to them for the show notes. You get two of them for $10, and they're like about paper sized. And the best part is you peel the backing off and then stick it to your wall. And it's supposed to be like really gentle adhesive in that you can take it off and stick it back to something up to 5 times, they say, and it won't destroy your wallpaper. But then, you know, the thing is just you have whiteboards all around you. So whenever you get that idea or whenever you need to work something out, you have a whiteboard there to do it. And I think that's what I always use whiteboards for. I always love to have one on my wall because I'm like, I need to think about that. And, you know, you grab your dry erase marker and go up and whiteboard it out. And I think it's very important.
Yeah, I know a lot of programmers that actually use whiteboards like throughout the day. So
it's like a saying, I mean, in our industry, like go whiteboard it, you know. Mm-hmm. So these ones aren't big. You can get big ones. I couldn't find them on Amazon, but I've heard talk that you can get like basically a wallpaper that is a giant whiteboard. So you could have like a whole wall of whiteboarding, which is really cool. We were looking for it at work, but I couldn't find it. But these are good for just like around the house, like right next to your computer right here, you know, on my wall. I could stick it, write things that I want to work out or things I want to remember really quick for later. Check it out, the peel and stick whiteboards. All right. Let's get into our web apps this week. Our first web app is called Sipgate.
Sipgate, all right. What is Sipgate?
Well, SIP is an open source protocol for doing voice over IP phone telephony stuff, right?
It's kind of like Skype or...
Skype does it, but the whole point, I believe, of SIP is that it's a protocol that's open so that, you know, if you get a SIP phone, your SIP phone will work with a SIP service. Mm. So with Skype, there's a couple companies out there making specifically like Wi-Fi Skype phones. But you can only use Skype. This, you know, you buy a SIP phone, you can use any SIP service. This is, I think, what usually companies do when they, you know, they go like total VoIP for their data or their voice in their office.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what Sipgate is a service that allows you to do sort of SIP telephony stuff, but, you know, for small scale, really cheap things. What I really like about it, you log on, it also does some other like Google Voice things. So usually when you get a SIP service, you get voicemail with it, you know, but it's like your traditional voicemail, like dial in, press this. Sipgate is kind of like Google Voice in that you get a phone number. You don't have to mount it to an existing phone. You get a SIP phone number. You can connect a SIP phone to it, or you can use their online, they have a SIP software, so you can use it on your computer like Skype if you want to. But it does like the voicemail in the browser, you know, kind of like Google Voice. I can go in and listen to my voicemails via MP3. It doesn't do the transcription. That's kind of a big Google thing. But and you can also send faxes with it. And the cool part is, too, if you can buy, they have Sipgate 1, which is free. You get a number and then you can sort of do all the cool Sipgate stuff. But you can also get Sipgate Teams for like X number of peoples. And it does really cool things like, if you're using your Sipgate phone, like instead of dialing their full phone number, you can have internal extensions and it knows to sort of just route to that.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah. It does cost to like receive and send calls to outside numbers, but internal SIP communication is free. SIP to SIP is free within Sipgate. So like if you have a team, you could get like a Sipgate 3, which has 3 people, 3 numbers. You can dial the extension and that doesn't cost you money to call someone else on your Sipgate line. But other than that, then, you know, when you receive phone calls or receive and send faxes as well, it does cost money. It's fairly cheap. I believe it's like one, oh, what was their rates? Where's it at?
I thought it's 60.
So it's 1.9 cents per minute for domestic calls to and calls to Canada, which is on par with Skype. The one thing Skype does have, which is nice though, is you can buy an unlimited plan. This doesn't have an unlimited plan, and I kind of wish it did. Mm-hmm. Because I kind of like the idea of, you know, being able to just not worry about it. You know, it might be a little more expensive some months, but some months you might save money. I kind of like the unlimited plan. This doesn't, but it's, you know, it's pretty cheap. It's definitely not expensive.
The one thing this has on its free account that Skype doesn't is a free phone number though.
Yeah, exactly. So you
free
get an
actual phone number. That
yeah, exactly.
Call from a landline.
So I have a SIP, you know, I have a SIP, SIPgate account right now. You can call my, you could call that number right now. I don't have to pay extra for that phone number or anything. It is in California. They haven't really, you know, it's not like Google Voice yet where they have a bunch of different places all around, but.
So do they have software that you can dial in and then it pops up on your computer or?
Right. Yeah. They have software that's kind of like Skype where you run it on your computer. And if someone calls you, it pops up on your computer or you can buy any SIP phone. And I think for me, that's like the really cool advantage because there's a lot of phones like the Skype phones are not cheap and the cheaper one or two, there's like three companies making them. SIP phones are everywhere. You can buy a SIP phone, you can buy cheap ones, you can buy expensive, cool ones. Hmm. And they all work with SIPgate because it's an open source protocol.
And then you can just like do dial an extension. If we had the team one, I could just dial like 123 or whatever and it goes to your phone.
Right. And you can set the extensions for your team and everything like that. So I could be like extension 1111 because, you know, I'm, you know, number one. But, you know, and so I think that's really cool. And I think it's a good way for teams that are distributed or even if you're not distributed, but you want, you know, phone number. I think it's a good, cheap SIP service that does other added value added features. You know, like I'm not sure, you know, like every cable and every cable company is offering like phone plans now. And I think that's SIP too. But again, this is nice. It's independent of your ISP. And plus, it has like the online voicemail and fax stuff, which is really handy to have around.
Yeah, so I'm looking at these SIP phones. They're actually just, you know, like the modern office day phones. That,
yeah.
If you're using VoIP in an office, they're just regular phones, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's, I think the only big downside for me is that they don't have an unlimited plan where you can call out unlimited because I don't, you know, I like an unlimited plan. I'm that type of person. I don't like to worry about it.
I don't
it.
Like bandwidth caps and restrictions on right. service, even though I probably wouldn't even go over the minutes.
Right.
I just don't like the idea of it.
But with this, you can prepay minutes or if you want to prepay for X number of minutes, but also then you just put your number in and it'll just, I mean, this is how phones used to be. We're kind of spoiled these days, but when I was a kid, I remember the whole point of the phone was like long distance was per minute. You know, mm-hmm. we kind of got spoiled with unlimited plans. I have a feeling that, I mean, if these guys did an unlimited plan that was on par with Skype, I think that this might take off. So I'm really jazzed about it. I think that it's something to think about if you have a small company and you're growing. Like, I mean, you know, I've been thinking about a small company, or small business type stuff, and I think this would be a good, great service to have. Plus, again, I think the thing is, it's just if you don't want to have to do your phone conversations through your computer, you know, which can be, is okay with, you know, Skype, it's nice, but I like to have a phone. I like to have a phone. And with SIP, you can do all kinds. They have like boxes where you can you connect it for your SIP, but then you connect an actual, like any cheap phone that you buy or any phone that you might already have that, you know, through it, and you don't have to worry about it.
You know what this is? It's kind of like a zero config asterisk box. Like they have like auto attendance and different things you can, all these different services you can have. You know, a lot of this stuff, if you, other than buying, like, you still have to get the phone number and some hardware, but you could do this open source with like Asterix, which is a open source like PBX software, but it's super complicated to do this. This is great. Like, this is just zero config, $2 a month for like the team version, and, or no, it's $19.95 for the three. I thought I saw two. For the three person.
Surprising. Let me look. It's $20 a month for three people.
Which gives you
three users, and then you can start having groups too, which is really cool. Like when you, so SIP one is just one person, just my phone number. That's fine. When you start doing group stuff, when you start doing the teams, you can get groups. So you know, like here's, you know, if someone calls our, I think maybe you get phones that are combined or combined voicemail.
Yeah, there's voicemail, feature rich, personal greetings, MP3s.
Yeah,
saves as MP3s. A voicemail for groups.
Right. So
you
can
forward messages to, like, if me, you and our friend Rob, if we were developing or something, I want to send a message to all of us. You know, you just do the message once and send it out.
Right. Or like this is clearly a support phone that the whole support group should be able to see and respond to, you know. So I mean, I was really jazzed when I saw this because I think it's a cool idea. I really like them embracing SIP, and I like the idea of, you know, taking this sort of technology like SIP that is around and can be useful but is kind of a pain, and making it easy for small people, small businesses to run and do without having to, you know, play around with a open source solution that might be difficult to configure.
Yeah, and like faxing, faxes goes right to a PDF. That's like awesome. So
yeah. So that is our web app of the week. I thought SipGate was so cool. I figured we'll take it. We'll leave our whole web app section to SipGate because, I mean, check it out. I'm really excited about this. I'm thinking about, you know, in the future, as I start, you know, striking out, maybe starting a company with, you know, a small amount of employees, like two or three. And this is a great solution that I'm really excited about.
All right.
All right. So, hey, if you guys, and I'm talking to you, you people out there listening, if you have some news, a follow-up, or a web application or a geek tool that we should look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can get check us out by going to twitter.com/faceoffshow. Tweet us out. Send us an email. We get lots of, we've been getting a lot of great suggestions lately, and I love to hear from you guys. So we appreciate it. And go and tell us about all the cool stuff out there that we're missing because we know we are.
All right, let's get into the topic. As promised, we're going to get into the web security part two. This one's going to detail the types of attacks that are out there and kind of explain a little bit about them.
Cool.
So the first one is client-side manipulation. oh, by the way, if you missed our first part of the security episode, go back a week and check that out.
Yep, we'll put the link in the show notes.
So the client-side manipulation, this is a good example of this is if you have a lot, so we talked about Google Checkout and PayPal back a little while ago. A lot of, sometimes it depends on how you do the integration, but you can actually have like a price in the button, the form button that you, you know, add to cart.
Right.
Client side manipulation would be someone going in and changing the price and then send it to the server.
Okay.
So what you have is, so typically as a web developer, you're thinking, well, I'm displaying this page and when they click this button, that's, you know, right. Clicks it, right? Well, HTTP is stateless, and so
I can dig around with that.
You can manipulate what gets sent. So the bottom line is all of the validations on everything should be server-side. So if you're doing a JavaScript validation saying the username should be this many characters long or only have A through Z characters or whatever, and you don't do that on the server side, but it's like in the JavaScript. Somebody could just turn their JavaScript off.
Right.
Send some data in there.
Right. I mean, a great example of this is we're building a web app right now, and we made a JSON REST API. And we're going through and writing documentation for it, you know. And you kind of get into the zone of thinking like, well, they'll only know what's documented. But the truth is, I mean, our app uses that API. That's, you know, one of the cool parts about like using this Rails system is because you just write your app based on your own API. And then you kind of take that and make it available to people. Well, they can look at any of the code that we have because it is using the API and see, you know, how we're sending it, what we're sending, what values there are, you know, so you have to kind of assume that definitely, especially on server side, that it's all safe. And even though you're documenting stuff, people can find other things and you have to make sure that those things are secure.
Yeah. Actually, I just thought of another one, a perfect example. Back in the early days of websites, a lot of people put like JavaScript password protection things, right. But the password was actually in the code. or you could just bypass it completely by just changing the HTML a little bit.
Right. I mean, you can look at any code and you can see what people are sending. And then you can use a plugin like the Firefox plugin poster that we use, and you can make any HTTP call. I mean, that's all the browser is doing is your sort of standard HTTP call, and you can change any of the parameters and do what you want. And if you're not prepared for that on the server side, then it'll get you.
Yep. The next one, this is the most common attack according to the Open Web Application Security Project. We'll link to that. Is SQL injection. So what SQL injection is where the user has something to say about, so user input, it often involves user input, and you're running an SQL query that uses part of that user input.
Right.
And the user, you don't think, as a developer, you don't think the user is going to be putting SQL commands in the user input because you're thinking, you're expecting like a zip code or an address or something.
Right.
What happens is it ends up affecting the SQL. So an example would be like a login system, username and password. You know, as a web developer, you're thinking, I'm expecting a username, maybe some A through Z characters and some password. But what they end up doing is maybe on the password, they put some characters and then they put a comment and they say, or 1=1.
Right.
And what that effectively does is, let's say in your code, you've got the username and the password must match. Well, they've just added or 1 = 1. Well, right. 1 = 1 always is true. And yeah. So you could basically bypass authentication. You're just right. You go right in.
Select star from users where username equals blah, password equals blah, or 1 = 1. Hey, exactly. 1 = 1, you're authenticated.
Yeah. So if a person puts or 1 = 1 as their password, they basically just go right in.
Right.
So that's a classic one that often gets looked over. Ways to, another one also is data can actually get dropped. You know, we got the classic, what is it?
XKCD cartoon where he's like, hey, Mrs. Your son, you know, semicolon drop table students, you know? Yeah, that can happen. You end this. I mean, it's most where this happens is you're executing the SQL statement regardless. Mm-hmm. And usually it's at the end is where you put all your conditionals. So if someone puts in that conditional, like comma, that ends that SQL statement and you can just write another one.
Mm-hmm. So usually what they say when you're looking through vulnerabilities and things, they often say improperly sanitized data. Mm-hmm. And what that usually means is whenever you are expecting something from the user, you should never trust that the user is going to just give you that type of information. They could give you or 1 = 1 or some SQL statement.
Right.
You should one example is whitelisting. I'm going to skip to whitelisting real quick. Is if you've got a zip code, you should expect, and you're not doing it, let's just throw out Canada for now because they have letters in theirs. You would expect numbers only, right?
Right.
So one way to whitelist is say only accept numbers. Everything else gets dropped.
Right. Yeah.
And then you a person can't really make an SQL statement with just numbers.
Right.
They can't comment stuff out. They can't add or 1 = 1.
Right. Or like the classic with PHP, I believe there's like a MySQL escape function that takes any character and escapes it to make it safe for MySQL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that is as far as MySQL, this is just a data field. It's not actual.
Now, so I was reading a little bit about escaping, and it is effective most of the time, but there are some weird things that people could do, like double backspace, and then it escapes. The escape actually makes it a non-escape. In certain things, they get very clever on what they do. Basically, though, that whitelist is the most secure, but it's the hardest to implement because you've got to think like a lot of times people like whitelist names, like a name should only be A through Z upper and lowercase, mm-hmm. and then somebody's got a special character or they got a hyphen in their name and you know that's not too good. Like if I had a name with a hyphen, I would be kind of mad if I went to a site and it stripped it out.
Right.
No.
But again, this is sort of like the classic example is whitelisting where you'd be like, oh, I'll just whitelist it from the front end. So if we can go back to like the previous topic, you know, I'll just whitelist it on the front end. And if you don't whitelist on the back end, then I can use, you know, any sort of, you know, HTTP thing to send whatever I want to it.
Yeah. Very good point. If you use JavaScript to whitelist, that does you no good for the server side. So you need both.
Yeah.
So, and then there's blacklist. You could say, we're not going to accept backslashes or forward slashes or SQL comments or, but blacklisting it's easier than to implement as, whitelist, but there's always the possibility that you're going to miss something.
Yeah, totally.
Or a hacker is going to figure out a way to undo what you did by using triple backslashes or something, you know? So always, you know, whitelist if you can, but it's not always, easy. To do. Another one is to use prepared statements. These are static SQL queries that cannot change the conditionals. It can only change based on the variables. So this is a good way to do. And they're also prepared statements also can help speed up the app because the SQL is expecting that statement.
Right.
So it preserves the structure of the intended query. The user can't really change the conditionals, like I said. So those are like four different ways. So you got escaping, blacklist, whitelist, and prepare statements.
Yeah.
To help prevent those.
Yeah. And SQL injection is a big deal. I mean, it's just, it happens a lot. I think, like you said, clearly, according to those people, it was the number one. And it, like, that's for me. And this is, again, we get into the problem of using things like frameworks, right? So frameworks are usually pretty smart. That's one of the things frameworks do. A lot of them, right? Is what is the code that that people tend to write the most? Let's put it in the framework so they don't have to write that. But then again, you get into the problem of then you have a framework with the same thing. And if they forget one thing, then it's easy to find any website using that framework and inject it in.
Very true. The second most common vulnerability is cross-site scripting. This is usually abbreviated XSS.
XSS.
What this is where a user, it's kind of similar to the two previous ones we talked about, is where a client injects a script onto a website. And this is, and you know, this is user input. You know, this is like when you're commenting on a blog, submitting an article to somewhere, or, you know, you're providing input to the site. According to Symantec in 2007, 80% of all security vulnerabilities, this was for websites, was this. I think in 2007, a lot of people were like not as wise to this type of attack.
Right, I think that's kind of when it just started. It started really escalating.
So when I first kind of thought about XSS, I was thinking, you know, JavaScript, but actually, you know, people can embed Java. They can just link to another URL where the jar file, you know, ActiveX, Flash, VBScript, or even HTML, you know, like an iframe. I've seen this on a blog that got hacked where they put a tiny 1 pixel by 1 pixel iframe that went to another site that loaded up a bunch of scripts and things.
Yeah, exactly.
So actually, even HTML can load up, you know, like a whole nother web page that could have a whole slew of scripts and stuff. So, so an example of this, I got off Wikipedia. Mallory posts a message with malicious payload to a social network. Then Bob reads that message. Mallory's cross-site scripting steals Bob's cookie. Then Mallory can now hijack Bob's session and impersonate Bob.
Right.
So you're thinking, well, what can I do with JavaScript? Well, in this example, he basically just stole the session. He can now post sites on, let's call it Facebook.
Right.
Let's pick on Facebook.
Hey, I'm Bill on Facebook.
Now you can start spamming over Facebook. I see this all the time.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit.
Get their cookies hijacked. One of the things that is usually required with cross-site scripting is, it's user input,
right?
Not sanitizing it. So basically the steps above the whitelisting and things are ways to prevent it. Whitelist, blacklist, HTML entities if you're using PHP.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that...
percent equals H if you're using Rails.
The next vulnerability we're going to talk about kind of ties into this, but cookies, if you think somebody's always, you know, XSS can be used to steal the cookies. So there's things you can do. You can bind a cookie data to a specific IP address. If that cookie comes from somewhere other than that IP address, you can just ignore the request. Mm-hmm. Modern browsers, IE6, Firefox 2.0, Safari 4, and Chrome have a flag for their cookie called HTTP only, which makes that cookie unavailable to client-side scripts. That's one way to prevent the cookie hijacking.
So what are the pain in the butts of doing this, right? Is that like I can't log into the website if I am myself, I can't log into it from like multiple computers.
Well,
whitelisting, blacklisting, and HTML entities really have no effect on the end user, right? No effect. You're okay. But
I think if it's done right, if you log in and you add another, you know how like if you look at Gmail and you go to the bottom, it says these are logged in, it has the IP address and things. You could tie, when that person logs in, you can tie multiple. You could tie that IP address to that cookie.
To the same session.
You can have multiple computers, but if it comes from one that hasn't logged in yet, that cookie hasn't logged in, isn't binded to that IP address that was logged in, then it wouldn't ignore it.
Interesting. Okay.
So what I kind of described above the cookie stealing is kind of a form of cross-site request forgery.
Right. Which is the next vulnerability.
Which is the next one we're going to talk about. This is also called like session hijacking. This happens on Facebook a lot. it's such a big target. But basically, this is the opposite of cross-site scripting where the server has the client gives the server something and the server is displaying mal information, a rogue script. Cross-site request forgery is you're using a perfectly good logged in user and you're sending the request through that user's computer, that user session to the server. So the server thinks that the request is coming from a perfectly good authorized user.
Mm-hmm.
So like Facebook, like once you steal the cookie or the person's session data, you can send requests to Facebook on behalf of that person. And Facebook's like, oh, okay, whatever.
This is them.
You're going to post a spam message on their wall. You know, that's cool. That's cool with us. It's coming from you. It's all right.
So this happens a lot with cross-site scripting. I mean, the example you gave above is sort of a perfect example of both, right? You're using cross-site scripting to grab that cookie. And then with that cookie, you're doing cross-site request forgery.
Yes. So like another way of saying this is unauthorized commands are sent to the web server from a user that the web server is known to be trusted.
Right.
The most common way to prevent this is to require a secret user token for all form submissions. this is usually done like in frameworks like Rails, okay. CodeIgniter, Django. So you don't really have to do much if you're using those. Just totally. Be aware of it. But if you're, you know, making your own.
Well, that'll explain like sometimes when you're doing Rails and like you're looking, you're using like the Firebug to look at like what is sent. You're like, what are those values? I didn't send those. That's like the framework trying to protect you from this.
Another thing to note about the cross-site request forgery is you have to go to another site to become vulnerable that takes over your, that looks in your sessions and takes them.
Okay.
That is a malicious site. Unless they use the vulnerability above the cross-site scripting where they put it on the actual site and then use the cross-site request forgery.
Interesting.
The next one is password security, and I put this one in here kind of because it seems to me that it's known by most people now.
Yeah.
Don't store passwords in plain text.
Don't store passwords in plain text. Make sure you have, even though your users may complain, try and have as strict of password policy as you can. Mm-hmm. It gets tough. I talk about this a lot or with my coworkers because where we work, I was part of a team that helped implement these new password policies. Or not, I was part of a support team that had to help give support for these new policies that were implemented at MSU. And one of the new policies was that, you know, required a special character in your password. And I mean, we got hell for this. People were freaking out. They're like, this is stupid. I have to have a special character in my password, you know? And it's one of those things of, it is very difficult, this sort of continuum of usability and security involving sort of passwords, right? Because if the password is too strong, or if you force the password too strong, people are going to write it down on post-it notes and put it underneath the keyboard, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's too weak, then they're going to have a password like cat, you know, or password.
Or AAA or QQQ.
Right, or, you know, ASDF. And then, so you're trying to provide that, but the thing is, I think it's important to raise awareness, maybe, you know, so if you're in a commercial entity trying to get people to come to your website, it's going to be difficult to try and say you have to have really difficult passwords, because they'll say, you know, screw you, I'm out. But I think just raising awareness, talking about it, you know, if we have some web people here, you know, that are working with clients, talking to their clients, explaining the importance of using, you know, really good secure passwords, it will help quite a bit. I mean, this happens a lot. A lot of things get brute forced with people with weak passwords, and that's, you know, important to raise awareness. It's a difficult problem as a web developer because, like I said, you know, you got to be like, you don't want to, you know, make your customers angry. But I think it's something that we need to always have as much conversation about as possible.
So things you can do is, like you said, have a password policy where you have to have a certain amount of characters, whatever. That can sometimes, you know, make people mad. Another thing you can do is lock the account after 3 password attempts, or make them do a CAPTCHA, some kind of a challenge. Banks usually lock people out. It usually frustrates a lot of people, but... you know, if it's something that's worth securing.
Right, like bank information is important.
That basically eliminates brute force because it's locked. And one of the problems with that, though, is you can DOS, you know, denial of service somebody's account by just constantly hitting it.
Right. Something to think about. But those are good steps to help prevent that.
And then never store it as plain text ever.
Use
a hash with some salt or whatever.
Clearly, yeah. Never,
even,
ever
even
do
a
that.
Simple hash is better than just plain text.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sometimes you go on websites that you can tell. So there's certain things, like if I log into a WordPress instance, I know I'm safe. WordPress does that. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you sign up for a website and it kind of looks kind of janky and you're like, I don't know. I bet these guys are stored my stuff in clear text. I just can feel it. And that's very frustrating.
Yep. So the other thing is there are some tools that can automatically test for some known vulnerabilities, and some of these are actually pretty comprehensive. They just go in and try all kinds of SQL injections and all kinds of goofy stuff. The first one is Nikto. I've used this one a few times. It's a simple Perl script.
You just like
give it a URL and it just goes through, and 5 or 10 minutes later, it's got it done. Another one is Skipfish. This one was made by Google. It had a lot of good reviews and things. I tried running it on my site, and destroyed my site. Not destroyed it. It took it down. It, like, while I was running it, and this was kind of my own fault. I had some configuration problems, but it basically sent all kinds of session. You know, it basically took my site down because it had so many users. It was like kind of a mini load test.
Yeah,
but it provided some great information. Another one, this is especially useful if you have a virtual private server, so you're running your own OS and things, is Nessus. You can just throw it there and it'll actually find ports that are open and servers, yeah. services that could have vulnerabilities. They actually can sometimes detect versions of SSH servers. And
totally. Yeah. That's what cool. we use at MSU for our distributed scanning. The security group, you add your server to it and they scan once a week and tell you all the, it tells you like critical and it tells you like warning level stuff. Like, hey, just so you know, this isn't critical, but you might want to do this. And then there's like, hey, you got a big problem. Like remember the SSL key problem with Debian?
Oh, yeah.
A while ago? I mean, that was like a big fiasco. It was like, holy, every single Linux server we have is critical, update. You know? So yeah. we had to update.
So those are three that should get you covered, should get you started.
Yeah. Again, this is, you know, Mark and I, we know a little, but I'm curious, you guys know a lot more than, I'm sure there's people out there know a lot more about this than us.
Definitely not security experts.
So, yeah, I mean, get on the show notes, comment on the blog. We really want to open a discussion with this because, I mean, we talked about it. Maybe we said something that may not be true. I don't know. This is a very fast moving field. We talked about like SQL injection and cross-site scripting are really big ones. That's a big problem when people do their home with it, you know, they homebrew their own stuff and you know, you got to check that. But there's all kinds of stuff up. So let's start a discussion. I want to talk to you guys on our blog comments. So get on faceoffshow.com and let us know. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to thank you guys for listening. And I want to remind you, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet, go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. All different kinds of ways you can subscribe on there. You can also leave feedback by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You know, if you want to just tweet us out, send us an email, any of that stuff, we'd love to hear from you guys. As we said, thanks for listening again, and we will see you guys next week.